Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There's always a lot more going on, a lot more going on in the spiritual life, in the process of training and enlightenment, training/enlightenment, really one process, than we can possibly be aware of, much less understand. Yesterday, I emphasized what I would call, to put it very simply, the shove from behind. The incentive to go deeply into meditation, to do something about intense suffering. And really as the only way to handle the deepest spiritual suffering. And this is usually where a deep meditation retreat begins. Very strongly on the pain and fear side of things. It is helpful to look at that, kind of step back and look at that in a way that abstracts from the intensity of it. And it can be unbelievably and indescribably intense. If you step back from that and from the most obvious kind of external manifestations of what a person is going through, and what you can say in a general way is that when a person goes into a deep, extended, naturally arising meditation retreat, not as a result of a willful striving, but as a result of really all the conditions being right for it, the timing being just right, everything coming to the right stage of spiritual ripeness at the right moment. When this happens, you say it's in general, it's because there is a critical mass, as the master liked to put it, of karma that has all been processed to the point it's ready for a kind of a flash conversion. It's ready for to take the final steps to the help of the eternal and undergo its ultimate transformation. That transformation, again, can be very generally described as an enlightenment. And a conversion. The enlightening of greed, hate, and delusion, or their conversion into compassion, love, and wisdom is the way Rim Master often liked to speak of it. So we can think of all these years of training as being kind of gradual and much less intense and stressful processing of the spiritual need. And then when all conditions are ripe, and it's worked its way right up to the surface, and the essential jangles or knots of remaining need are ready to get the direct help of the Eternal, then one needs to be able to go into full-time meditation, put aside external things and external concerns. And you see at the beginning of How to Grow to the Lotus Blossom, the Reverend Master doing this, just this. And this is one of the most important choices that a person makes in this, at this very crucial time. If one were to willfully choose to keep putting it off, then that karma that's all ready for help is going to come due in a way that may well, for particularly weighty karmas, take one's life. Certainly can produce very, very serious illness. And in fact, sometimes it may need to go one, it really just be no other way it can go than one of those directions. But more normally, it just means one needs to go into full-time meditation retreat and put away the external things, let go of them. Whether they be duties or distractions, it doesn't matter. One has to let them go and just go full-time into meditation. You know, full-time spiritual processing at the deepest level takes full-time effort in the direction of meditation. Now, everything I've said up till now is, I'm sorry to say, a bit misleading. Not intentionally misleading, because you simply cannot explain it all in words. And the little parts that you can explain, they can't all be explained at the same time. So now we have to go back in a way and look more at what you might call the source code, the kind of the part of it that we don't see when we're going through the process, that when we look back at a later date, we see very clearly. It, in the Amsterdam airport, probably in other big airports too, but I've encountered it most often at the Amsterdam airport when I go to visit Reverend Master Hector, who's a disciple of mine with a temple in the Netherlands. And in the Amsterdam airport, there's this long traveling walkway, mechanical walkway that is moving along at a good clip that you can step onto, and then it goes like maybe 100 yards and then there's a little break, then you step on it again and it goes another 100 yards, and it's moving at a fast clip. It's moving at a clip of a good maybe like 3 mile an hour walk. So imagine that it's the middle of the night at the Amsterdam airport. There's almost no one around. Even in Amsterdam, there's times when there's fewer people than at other times. Imagine it's the dead middle of the night, there's almost no one around, and you're in a rush to catch one of the few planes that is leaving at that time, the hour of the night. And you've got your bags with you, and you're late to the gate, and you've got to make it, or you miss, you know, your wedding in Rhodesia, or whatever it is. And you run onto this moving walkway, and you're in such a fluster, you don't even notice that you ran onto it, and you keep running at the same clip. Well, now, because what I remember from my I think I remember from my high school physics, velocity is additive. Now you are going not only at the clip you were going when you were running on your own, but now you're going at the additional clip that moving walkway is going at. But you're in such a rush, in such a fluster, you don't notice. This is the way it can be at the beginning of a big retreat. Everything is so difficult, and the effort, the resolve that has to be raised to do what you're doing is so great that you do not recognize at that point that you're actually being carried by the eternal. That you got into this thing in the first place as a result of the merit of all the training you'd done, and the eternal taking you up on your sincere, deep spiritual wish. And then while you think that you make the key choices to enter into this retreat, in actual fact, the eternal was drawing you into it all along. And your really big, important choices are just saying yes. And then doing the thing that lays out in front of you that is your part to do, that the eternal will not do for you. But in fact, all the really heavy lifting is being done for you all along. Now, if you look at the beginning of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, there's very little indication in the early chapters that Reverend Master recognizes the degree to which she has actually been drawn into this, not so that she'll die, but so that all the karma will get cleaned up with the eternal doing the heavy part of the work. And things were simply so difficult, and the possibility of death was so evident that very understandably, neither she nor, I imagine, anyone else in those circumstances recognizes at that point the degree to which they are safely in the hand of the eternal. But one thing Reverend Master was, she was a quick study. And you see her getting onto it really fast in the early chapters. When she comes to that great, I remember in one of the really most, for me always one of the most memorable visions, coming up to that great sheer glass mountain and asking, how can I do this? This is not, does not seem possible. I'm too weak, I'm too frail, I'm only human. And then she gets a hold of her will and says, I can do it and I will. She looks up and her heart really cries for help. And then she finds herself at the top and able to move on from there. Of course, that wonderful teaching of that vision is showing the extent of human extremity in great times of great need, and the power of a true grasping of the will in the direction of faith. What is it that brings one, enables one to transcend? It is grace. Grace with the capital G. The hand of the eternal reaching out to do that for us which we cannot do ourselves. It offers itself to us and we have to say yes. If we look down and say, I can't do this, I have not been good enough, I am not good enough, I am not worthy enough, it will just wait and wait and wait until we are willing to look up. until we're willing to say, I can, not as a result of my willpower, but as a result of thy grace, thy compassion. Then things can move forward. I gave an example from my personal experience of my running to the meditation hall. The time of my own great spiritual crisis in 1976, early 1977. Well, what I emphasized then was the push from behind. But I'll tell you that what was really making me run was much more the pull from ahead than the push from behind. Because when I got into that meditation hall, I had a deep instinctive sense that a lot more was happening there than just sitting under the pain. An indescribable sense. I mean, this was not intellectual. It was all I could do to just get myself there and sit there and be as still as I could be. And keep coming back to just sitting there. I had no intellectual understanding of this. I knew nothing of this process. Decades of training and much more experience of this, some of it in much playing out much more slowly over much more extended periods of time, has taught me a great deal about it. Plus, Reverend Master, of course, taught us everything she could about it. Looking back, I'm amazed at how hard she kept trying to teach us, and in my own case, how much of it I kept just not getting. You just can't get it till you can get it. But bless her for trying. She used to say, you throw enough mud and some might stick. Well, at least a little stuck. At any rate, I spoke also of standing in morning service and weeping through the whole thing. It wasn't just grief. There's this great fire of longing, this great upwelling of longing. I didn't even know where it was pointed to. I certainly didn't know where it was coming from. But this is the sign, one of the what you call the confirmatory signs, and it can be an enormously powerful one of the conversion happening. The externalized longings getting refocused upon the eternal as a result of the letting go of the external things and the stepping forward into the darkness in pure faith, into the unknown in pure faith. Then a little while after one takes that step, this fire of longing starts to manifest, rising up and up so powerfully, it feels at times, it can feel at times like it could take your life. It can be so powerful. No longer pointed towards any external thing, no longer. What is the great big alternative to the having it pointed at the eternal? It really is, it's always human love in the end. It's always comes down to human love, human consolation, one form or another. This, of course, is the real spiritual reason for the monastic celibacy. It's not because sex is evil, bad, and nasty, or family life is evil, bad, and nasty. It's just to help with that longing going in the direction that is the direction of the monk's vocation. Full recognized reunion with the Buddha nature, with the eternal. And one can weep out of that great longing. And that great, that longing is a great love. Even before one knows what it is a love of, it is a love of the eternal. You could call it more accurately a longing love. It's only in the culmination and full fruition of Kensho that one discovers what it is that love is. Its rightful and true object and home. That does not necessarily mean a great dramatic lightning flash Kensho. It could be a much quieter one. There's various ways of getting there. The whole of our physical and material life is, as it were, the launching pad for this rocket of spirituality. The whole of worldly religion is like the very top level of this launching pad. But it's only in pure meditation and in the deepest understanding of the meaning of the precepts and putting that into practice that rocket takes off. And then it is a ride with which nothing else in the world can be compared. And in comparison with which all else is as dust. There's the story of Thomas Aquinas, who was certainly one of the smartest people who ever lived, and one of the greatest philosophers, and the man who, more than any other single man, set the course of Catholic theology for centuries after his lifetime. It is said that the story that I heard about him, he's sitting in Mass, I think in his old age, and he had what was probably a full Kensho at last. And he said after that, "All that I have understood is a straw in comparison with this." I'd like to close this talk with the verse that means so much to me and to, I know, my disciples. And it really expresses this so beautifully. The way the longing speeds you up and encourages you, even while the shove from behind of the pain is still can be very intense at times. The verse goes like this. The gift of the light of the Lord is everywhere. The palace of the Buddha nature is within ourselves. The deep, true heart wishes to go quickly so that their happy meeting will occur soon. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma.